Nancy Reisman, let's talk a little bit about your background. You're from here originally. Where'd you go to school?
I went to East High School in Williamsville, and before that, Heim and Maple West. And then I moved to Boston to go to university at Tufts University, and I went to graduate school at UMass Amherst.
Now, what about your family?
Well, my parents both grew up here. My mother was a visual artist. She went to Bennett High School, and she went to Buff State. And my father also grew up here. He was a physician. He was an allergist, and he went to UB. So they're hometown people.
Considering your first novel, I would assume Jewish.
Yes. We grew up mostly Reform, and my grandparents and great-grandparents emigrated here mostly from Eastern Europe.
So your first two novels, the first one is, I suppose, the classic first novel set in the town you grew up in, and obviously probably a lot of family stuff in there that your siblings and relatives recognize, but nobody else does.
I would say that's accurate. When I first moved to Boston and I found that I was interested in writing, I was surprised to find that I wanted to write about Buffalo, that was what was pulling me back. I had, thought, as the classic story, you go out and see the world and then you realize the world that is most important to you is the one back home. But The First Desire is set between 1929 and 1950, and it really goes into the world, a very heavily fictionalized world, I should say, that is based very loosely on my mother's maternal family, her mother's family, and a family that did, in fact, live on Lancaster Avenue and that did, in fact, own a small jewelry store. And so those play significant parts in the book.
For the benefit of our listeners, what was the family jewelry store name?
Well, it was Gamler Jewelers, but it wasn't. It was a relation of the larger Gamler Jewelers. It's a long, complicated story, but my great grandfather had the jewelry store, and then Harry, his cousin, came and founded the store that more people would be more familiar with.
Kind of classic immigrant situation of portable skills.
Exactly, yeah.
So you went to Boston, which is famous for its family sagas. Sometimes the family, and
that's
sometimes...
That's true. That's absolutely... That's true.
Coming out of the North End or out of Winter Hill. Okay, your second novel, Trompe L'Oeil, is about an Irish family.
It is. It's a Boston Irish family. So they have working class and immigrant roots, but they, somewhat like my own family, are established a couple of generations in. And for those of us who have spent a lot of time in Massachusetts, I know that you have connections in Massachusetts, the Irish cultural population, and connection is very deep. And I had a lot of close friends in the Boston Irish community, and for a time, some family members in that community. So
this is the generation that wants to move to Scituate and have a summer house so that their grandchildren can live in Hyannis or Dennis or something like that.
Something like that.
Both of these families, the Jewish family in Buffalo, the Irish family in Boston, have dysfunctional qualities. You obviously are interested in the dramatic possibilities of dysfunction.
Well, yes, and it's fair to call it dysfunction, but I also think that most families have very complicated interrelationships at some point or at some place or at some generation. But yeah, I am really interested in how families negotiate hard times and the stresses and what tears them apart and also what holds them together. There are, the ways in which love persists. And the moments at which people make choices to sort of separate and go in different directions.
In your first book, the one sister simply leaves, just gets on, goes out to Central Terminal, gets on the train, and heads to California. In the second book, the family's in Rome, and the four-year-old gets hit and killed.
That's right.
And that's the each is the pivotal point in the whole story.
That's right.
You wanted a pivot point. You didn't want a slowly evolving little tiny moves and shifts. And in both books, everything pivots on whatever happened to the mysterious daughter to the point where they sit Shiva for her and the four-year-old gets killed and the family's never quite the same.
Well, so one of the things that you're talking about is the difference between how plot accumulates or, you know, what the central questions are for readers. And for me as a writer, and I think for me as a writer, the question wasn't as much what happened, but why and how did everyone manage? How do you survive or how do you adapt? What are the ripple effects of such changes or such losses? And I think in the case of The First Desire, why was very important. You know, why this adult woman left her family and the family for quite some time did not know her fate. Readers learn her fate, that she has, in fact, taken off for California and chooses a kind of bohemian life. Feels very trapped by the life that she's been living and with family responsibilities, particularly after the loss of her mother. But there are clear trade-offs and losses for her, too. In the case of Trompe L'Oeil, yeah, the loss of the child, I think there's the question of how anyone navigates that. And makes it to another kind of life. But also for me, I think the question of how certain kinds of tragedies illuminate the fractures that were already there.
One of the things about the Irish family is I'm old enough to remember the great struggles of the women's movement, and one of them was you didn't get married right away. You maybe tried to find yourself before his graduation day when all those weddings around his graduation day and suddenly the woman is home without a degree and maybe with a kid or in this case, what, four kids finally. And she doesn't know who she is or who she is.
Yeah. Well, or I would say at least some of that has been hidden or repressed. I think so Nora, who's the wife, mother, central woman figure in the book, has an art background. She does go to college. But you're right. She doesn't really have the time and the chance to explore what working in that field would mean, whether professionally or sort of having more of a chance to do it in a personal way. So she has children, and she loves her children. And at first, everything seems okay. She's enjoying her life. And then as the responsibilities accumulate and life gets harder, there is that same question. And that is in the 70s when she's struck by the fact that she doesn't know who she is or she doesn't know what happened to her own goals, her own ambitions, the things that really nurtured her the most. And that she wanted room for that in her life and was confronting that tension.
It may reflect the fact that Massachusetts has the latest marriage age for both men and women and the most likely to stay married.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Well, I'm not sure that was the case in the 70s.
No,
but
it wasn't.
Yeah.
But I think some of that may be reflected in the children of those
sure
marriages of the 70s.
Sure.
Because certainly the children of the marriage that falls apart in Trompe L'Oeil would have different attitudes toward this stuff after watching their parents' first marriage, especially their dad's first marriage, go haywire.
Yes, I agree. I agree. I think that is true. I think there are four children, all of whom have very different sorts of responses
When you do readings, and I know you do, like the one you're here in Buffalo for, what kind of, you know, that reminds me of my family sort of stories do you hear?
Well, I've heard a lot of those stories, and it's very gratifying because what that says to me is that I've managed to capture something that feels authentic about family dynamics. When The First Desire came out, there was a period of time. There's a woman in sort of secondary character who's a mother in The First Desire, who's a very difficult woman, and she's very hard on her daughter. And when that book came out, there was a period of time, it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks, three different women, different ages, very different backgrounds, all approached me and said, "That was my mother. That was my mother." And I felt heartbroken for them because it was a very painful relationship that I had painted, and also hoped that in some way they felt that their own experience had been invalidated, that there was something that they related to and that they could see, and so I was glad for it ultimately.
You teach.
I do.
At Vanderbilt University. How do you teach kids in a college program, or even if they're not majoring in writing or something like that, to do this? Do you hand them a metaphorical shovel and say, look into your own family history, or what do you do?
Well, there are a number of things I do. I mean, one of the things is to start maybe not asking them to look into their own family history, although that's an option, but to start looking at the ways in which they perceive the world. And the uniqueness of the ways that they perceive the world, what they notice day to day, the visual images, the sound images, the things that are important to them, the things that they like. I mean, a lot of the other kinds of coursework that they do that we all need to do kind of pushes us towards taking in bodies of knowledge. And this is different. There's a sort of, effort to find what it is that's important to them individually. So, and that's separate from then looking at, well, how are stories made and how does language work and what are some models we can look at and what are the kinds of tools that you have at your disposal, and as if you were a painter, what can you develop, what skills can you develop, what's on your palette? So there are different kinds of prompts that I give students. Some of them are about thinking about their own memories and histories and families. And some of them may be very, very different looking at the world, looking at, for example, a story by the writer Amy Bender, who has a sort of surrealist twist, and finding ways to play with that.
But this is a generation, the one you're teaching currently, that everything's on the table. Nobody seemingly has any secrets. They're all on Facebook. Does this create a different dynamic in teaching them how to write?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not really sure that the relationship to Facebook is as important as more generally the relationship to visual media and to shorter forms and shorter methods of communication. They're less likely.
You mean we might get shorter novels in the future?
Well, you know, they're the students that I meet and that I spend time with are some of them have a wonderful sense of story when they think about film or when they think about their storytelling in their own family, for example. But they'll be less familiar with literary short stories. Some of them don't really know what that means or you know, it's just, maybe they've read less literary work on the whole than previous generations would have. So that's got to be
an issue. I mean, who reads Dickens in a high school program anymore?
That's true. So my feeling is that I'm meeting the students where they are, and there are some amazing short forms that that we work with, flash fiction, but also we bring in, you know, traditional short stories and also see what contemporary writers are doing with the form, and take a look. Some depends on the course and what we have time for, but we look at novels and we talk about novels, and I try to find novels that might be of interest to them and that are more either that are more contemporary or have a kind of hook that feels that might be resonant with where they are in life.
Do they have to be more than the dead white male stereotype?
Oh, they should be. Yeah. I mean, in terms of the choices of the literature, it's a great range that we take a look at.
Does that make a difference? Does that validate their experiences as they look forward to trying to write for their lives?
I really hope so. I really hope so. I felt myself, and now it's been a long time since I was in college, somewhat alienated when I was first taking English literature classes, American literature classes, 20th century American literature classes, and there were wonderful writers, but it was, you know, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, Bellow, Mailer, Hemingway, and
I didn't like Hemingway much.
Well,
but my generation was supposed to.
Well, they're supposed, you know, they're. I think that there's a lot to say for him as a skilled writer, and you know whether or not he's to your taste. But I think at that age and time of life, I was really looking for visions of the world that I could relate to, characters that I could identify with, a place, and it was alienating not to see and be reading literature that seemed to have very much to do with my experience at all, even tangentially.
So not Jane Austen.
Well, I did love Jane Austen, but in terms of think of young writers who are looking at the contemporary scene and looking to think about, well, how do I make my world into a piece of art? I think having those role models among contemporary writers is really vital.
Are you seeing a result of that in kids who've come out of the various MFA programs and the bachelor's writing programs? Are you seeing that turning up on the page, whether the electronic page or the paper page?
Sure. And, you know, as we've been talking, I've been thinking mainly about my undergraduate students. We have wonderful graduate students at Vanderbilt, and I think they're doing terrific work. I happen to be, I know that there's some controversy about MFA programs. My own feeling is that they are a kind of oasis for young writers. It's very hard to find places in our, or I guess in our culture, outside of universities. There are some great literary centers. Buffalo has a wonderful literary center. Not all cities have them. But how, you know, where do you go? Where do you meet other writers? Where do you learn how to do this if you're drawn to it? Where do you find that community? And
I don't know. I was on Montmartre a few months ago.
Well, yeah, France would be lovely. But, you know, for good or for ill, universities have become the place for now where many people find those communities, and it's through MFA programs, and they're vexed, and they have other institutional priorities. But ultimately, I think they're a very good thing.
Thank you, Nancy Reisman.
Thank you so much.